Welcome to the Vancouver Writers Fest's Books and Idea Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers Fest's 2021 festival season. This event is presented in partnership with SFU's Master of Publishing program. The Vancouver Writers Fest carries out its work and this event here today on the traditional, unceded, and ancestral territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. We are grateful to be here and are cognizant of the history of these lands and the necessary and urgent work that is still to come as we move toward reconciliation and Indigenous sovereignty. Today, we are honored to be hosting award-winning Nishka author Jordan Abel in conversation with celebrated journalist and author Tanya Talaga. As author David Sheriandi put it, Jordan's new book, Nishka, is a book of profound artistic, philosophic, and emotional power. Reading it, I was taught, heart-moved, and deeply humbled. Nishka is a piece of art and an autobiographical meditation that attempts to address the complicated legacy of Canada's residential school system and contemporary Indigenous existence. And now, on to the event. Your host today is Tanya Talaga. Tanya is an Anishinaabe journalist and speaker. She's worked for the Toronto Star, now the Globe and Mail, being nominated 5 times for the Michener Award in Public Service Journalism. Her first book, Seven Fallen Feathers, is a national bestseller, winning multiple nonfiction and writing awards. And her second book, All Our Relations, Finding the Path Forward, is also a national bestseller and award nominee. She's a Massey lecturer, honorary doctorate, and the CEO of Makwa Creative, a production company focused on Indigenous storytelling. She's also a former guest curator at this festival. And Jordan Abel. In an interview with Calgary Herald, Jordan Abel laments, "This book is a book that I really wish someone else had written so I could learn from it, but that's not the situation we're in." An award-winning Nishka poet, Abel steps up for all of us to confront painful truths with a deeply personal autobiographical meditation. Nishka explores the complexity of the Indigenous experience, speaking on residential schools and intergenerational trauma with an innovative meld of artistic interpretation and historical evidence. Nishka might ask more questions than it answers, but it all contributes to an imperative conversation, one we look forward to being a part of today. Please welcome Tanya Talaga and Jordan Abel.
Bonjour. Tanya Talaga Nagisnakas Kam Musko Pimojujet Pinishish Nagisnakas. I'm so thrilled to be here today. I'm coming to you today from Tacaronto, home of the Mississaugas of the Credit, traditional territory of the Haudenosaunee and the Huron-Wendat people. I'm so excited to be leading this discussion with Jordan Abel. I love Jordan. It's true. I do. You know?
I'm also here.
I love the work that Jordan does. And I remember being captivated by you by hearing you read. And also to meeting with you when my first book, Seven, came out. We had a discussion at the Winnipeg Library. And it was a really special, it was a special time for me. And I am so grateful that you took the time to meet with me. And then you showed me around the U of M. I am grateful for your kindness and your friendship. And so it was an honor to receive your book. It was actually sent to me as soon as it came out. I know Jared Bland sent it to me and with a note saying, "I hope you enjoyed this book." And it's absolutely beautiful. Congratulations.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
It must have been, you know, I know everyone always probably starts conversations like this, but I've got two things that I wanted to start with you, actually. I wanted you to introduce yourself to us.
Sure. My name is Jordan Abel. Right now I am in Edmonton on Treaty 6 territory. I think for the purposes of this book, you know, I often introduce myself as a Niska author, and you know, within the first, you know, 20 pages, 10 pages or so of this book, you know, I think that gets exploded a little bit. And, you know, instead, maybe it would be useful to say at the outset here that, you know, I'm an intergenerational survivor of residential schools, and an urban Indigenous person. And, you know, well, my family is Niska, you know, and from the Niska Nation, you know, I think I primarily, think of myself as having this kind of triangulation of, you know, urban indigeneity, Niskanness, and intergenerational survivor as the three things that's underpin, you know, my identity and my relationship to indigeneity.
Beautifully, beautifully said. And that is exactly why I asked you to introduce yourself. I knew it was a loaded question. Totally. And, you know, the subject of your book, you know, the one of the subjects of your book, I think that writing a memoir is incredibly brave. And I just want to say that you are brave. You're brave for writing this book and telling your truths and telling them so honestly and beautifully. Because it's not easy, is it? You know, it's not easy. It's like it's not easy. So I actually wanted to start off by asking you a question about the formation of this book.
Sure.
Where did it come from? And how long has it been living inside your mind?
Totally. I think that's, you know, such an important question to start out with, you know, and the really short answer is, you know, for the entirety of my being here, you know, on this earth, you know, I think, you know, this book, you know, has really, you know, lingered with me all my life, you know, and in particular, you know, I would say, you know, some of the questions that like the book begins with, you know, are questions that really, you know, shape the entirety of the work, and those questions being, you know, what does it mean to be Indigenous but to be dispossessed from your home territory? What does it mean to be an intergenerational survivor of residential schools? Mm-hmm. What does it mean to be dispossessed of both Indigenous knowledge and Indigenous land? And, you know, how do you navigate the world as an urban Indigenous person who's constantly being, you know, asked, you know, what your relationship to your home territory is, you know, and you know, maybe like further than that, you know, how do you think through a relationship to a home territory that is absence and that is, you know, severed from you in some way, and so, you know, those questions are have been deeply important to me throughout my entire life. Not that I've been able to articulate them like that, you know, throughout the entirety of my life. Like, it took me a long while to figure out how to ask those questions, and to you know, find the words to put to those questions. But those questions were still there, you know, lingering with me before that moment, and I was just struggling with them and trying to you know, find answers even when I couldn't, you know, properly ask those questions or answer them, and you know, in that way, you know, I would say this book is absolutely a lifelong project, and also, you know, one that is not so much timely as it is overdue, you know, so you know, part of the way this book came together was through my work in SFU's PhD program in their English departments. And that was a really important moment for me, important and generative moment for me as a writer, because anytime you do something like that, there's all of these artificial moments, you know, of deadlines, you know, and dates and importance, you know, goalposts that you have to hit. And I think, you know, in some ways, you know, that construct, I think, really catalyzed the beginning of the process of writing the book, and that process kind of snowballed into the book that you have in front of you.
Talk to me about how you physically put the book together too. I mean, it's absolutely stunning. I love how you used notes, and in your notes are just like, these are like notes of a life, right? They're just these memories that you've had, things that have happened to you in your life. And then talk to me about how the photographs, the screens, the physical layout of the book is something to behold.
I'm so glad. I'm so glad it spoke to you. I think this is part of the book that, you know, I really, you know, if you've, for those of you listening who have seen some of my other work, you know, you'll know that I'm a very visual yes. writer in yes. many ways, and literally visual, you know, where I'm often, you know, thinking about image and photography and whatnot. So the book came together in this very particular way. So, you know, it started, you know, with those questions. And I often, you know, think about this work as a problem-based work, you know, where really I was, you know, trying my best to provide an answer that was nuanced and complicated to all of those questions I was just asking. And that was a really difficult thing to do in many ways. So, you know, part of the way that I began to find my way into it was by going through my family archive. So I had this box of documents and photographs that my mom gave to me at some point. Several of the documents, I should say, you know, ended up, you know, appearing in the book. But my first interaction, you know, with that archival box was to go through every document, was to read everything I could, and look at all the photographs and try and piece together these moments that had these enormous impacts on my life, you know, that I, you know, was unfamiliar with in some cases before reading through some of those documents. So the way the book began was by transcribing some of those documents and positioning them, you know, in an InDesign file, you know, and just trying to, you know, as I say at the end of the book, you know, part of that process was just trying to hold up all the pieces and see how they all fit together. You know, so part of my work as a writer was, you know, partly also the work of curation, where I was just singling out certain documents and certain moments and certain photographs and you know, seeing where they aligned in relation to each other. And that's also, you know, how the photography and the screenshots and the images, you know, came to be part of the book. That, you know, as I was going through those documents, there were many textual moments, you know, that came from, you know, court documents, for example, court affidavits or you know, other, you know, handwritten documents from my mom, or specific NISCA eligibility criteria, etc. So there's like a whole bunch of things in there. But there was also all of these photographs of my mom and my dad, and of my dad's artwork. And my dad is a painter and a carver, and he did all kinds of visual artwork. And as I was going through those images, I really felt like I needed to include them, that they were part of the story somehow. And as I progressed into the process of writing the book, it also became really important for me to put my own work in dialogue with my dad's work, to create a moments of intergenerational collaboration, and then to circle back to one of the origin points of your question. I also ended up putting all of these photographs of the Coquilita residential school, which is where both of my grandparents on my dad's side attended, and then I put in all of these screenshots, part of that particular section, was about trying to articulate a moment and a thing and a feeling that I was unable to articulate through words, but I could talk about it through image in some way. There's sections of screenshots, in some ways, represents or point to, my many failings as a prose writer, and instead point to these other, strengths that I have as a visual writer or a poet or something.
Mm-hmm. I love, or I find it an incredibly haunting and an incredible device to the dislocation, the prints, the notes, the time stamps. It's like the scatterings of one's life and the dislocation of one's life. And, our people were violently separated from the land. Colonization did that. And the policies, the arbitrary policies of the Canadian government, who decides who's Indigenous and who's not. And, I was really struck by that with reading your book. For instance, a little example of that is when you stand in front of a totem pole at the Royal Ontario Museum.
Right. Yeah. I think that was... that was such an incredibly difficult moment for me as just a human being to be, reunited in some ways, with this totem pole that was, stolen from my community and also from my life. I think, there's an absence there, that I lived with, that I continue to live with, is indefinable in some ways. I wrote about that section of encountering that totem pole. I first wrote about that encounter in my first book, The Place of Scraps, and that book, makes this appearance in Nishka that I think is important for me as a writer, because this work is in some ways, about circling back to my previous writings. The note sections that you point to, those snippets of creative nonfiction where I reflect on often, you know, through vignette, you know, like particular moments that and particular encounters that I have in my life, you know, those kinds of creative nonfiction moments, I think were presence, you know, but maybe less prominence in the place of scraps. And so, you know, I see that work as kind of continuing a trajectory, in part that I started much earlier in my career. But the timestamps, you know, and the transcripts of academic talks, you know, I think those were really, you know, a new moment for me, and one that, you know, I struggled with at certain times. So the book has, I think, maybe four or five transcribed academic talks. And instead of positioning, you know, those prose essays, you know, on the page, I instead transcribed an audio recording from each of those talks, and then reposition that audio, you know, with specific timestamps, so that the reader can, you know, hopefully, you know, encounter those particular words as being words that were spoken publicly at a particular moment in time, at a particular place, that have, you know, particular pauses. Yes. And, you know, yes, particular spaces that are open to them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's, you know, it's so so devastatingly clear and so devastatingly human, you know, the experiences you have, and so personal. And so in memoir writing, it's so difficult. And I think the use of the smaller notes and the reflections and the timestamps, it makes it even more intimate and more urgent. For instance, your Catherine Abel excerpt from a handwritten notebook, you know, and seeing some of those notes from her, it's just riveting. And, you know, you're there, and I that must have been so difficult for you to see, to read from her.
Yeah, it was honestly really devastating in many moments, you know, particularly those notes from my mom that I transcribed, you know, in part because, you know, I'd heard versions of those stories and versions of those events, you know, as they're, you know, filtered, you know, through her, you know, over a series of many, many years, you know. And I think one of the things that happens, you know, when you hear a story over and over again, you know, throughout your life, is, you know, you kind of just remember the main pieces of it, you know, and like the details fall away a bit. And mm-hmm. and so to encounter those particular moments, and, you know, there are many very specific moments, you know, in there that are about my mom and my dad, and, mm-hmm. you know, and this a series of like really deeply impactful events that happened, you know, between them, and, you know, for my dad in particular, and, you know, trying to find a way to write about those, and trying to find a way to think about, you know, all the things that happened, you know, as mm-hmm. as part of a longer history, you know, which was to say that, you know, part of the arguments that I'm making, you know, in this book, you know, is to say that, you know, some of those violences, you know, particularly, you know, the ones that that, you know, center around my dad, you know, probably should be talked about in relation to residential school violence and in relation to violences that, you know, originated in my grandparents' generation, and trying to understand that, and also trying to understand my dad, and trying to understand, you know, some of those early moments in my life that I didn't, you know, that, you know, I wasn't even old enough to commit to memory. Yeah. And yeah, you know, I think that was, you know, I would, you know, if I'm being totally honest, I would say, you know, the writing process for this book, you know, was deeply wounding for me at many different moments. And, you know, I did, you know, very much consider not moving forward, you know, with the writing of this book, you know, at so many different moments, just because it felt too overwhelming, it felt too personal, it, you know, it just felt like, you know, just, you know, it, yeah, it just felt painful sometimes to open up the document on my computer and try to add more to it, you know, and it especially, it felt especially painful to do so in some ways, you know, with the scrutiny of, you know, advisors, you know, or supervisors, you know, in an academic setting. And that part was so difficult. You know, but I think there were moments, you know, that I in the writing process that propelled me forward. And I think, you know, one of those moments, so, you know, I started writing this book in my PhD, and, you know, I was in the midst of, you know, I just kind of finished, you know, writing the first draft, so to speak, or like the very first initial draft, like the first 80, 100 pages. And then I, you know, took this role as the writer in residence at the University of Manitoba. And I went to this writers festival in Ontario, and I met you, and I, you know, read your book, Seven Fallen Feathers. And I thought, you know, that it was so incredible in so many ways, and, you know, spoke to so many similar things that I saw happening, you know, in my own life, you know, and, you know, spoke to, you know, it spoke to a deep colonial history that I really felt was important to always keep in mind. And, you know, that book for me, you know, was one of the ones that propelled me forward, that I felt like, you know, I had a touchstone to point to say that, you know, Tanya did this writing and it was wonderful, and that, you know, I could come at this problem, you know, and this problem of talking about what it means to be an intergenerational survivor of residential schools, you know, what it means to exist in the wake of that violence, that I could come at that problem, you know, from my own personal direction and vectors, and that, you know, that would be a pathway forward.
Chimigwech, for that. I'm grateful and honored that you had that connection with my writing, and you also felt that connection as well that I have with intergenerational trauma, and, you know, and it's definitely fuels everything that I do. I think that that's who we are as First Nations people, and, you know, and we're complicated, right?
Yeah.
As you know, it's just like, yeah, this whole book is about this. I'm like reading this book, and it's interesting. And also too, Jesse Wente's book that I'm speaking to him about for the Writers Fest as well. I see versions of myself in both of these books, you know, like I get it. Like, I'm like, oh yeah, I get that feeling of absence from community and from land, and not knowing who you are and how you explain it. You know, you had so much I want to talk to you about with that. It's just, I get it. It's almost like, you know, you always feel like, are you Indian enough?
Right? Totally. Yeah.
Like, and it's, and there's lateral violence in our communities that makes you feel like that sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, you don't get it all the time, but it's there. And that violence though comes from the schools. That comes from those policies, right? And it's devastating. It truly is, you know, and just on that point, your exchange with Chief Robert Joseph.
Right. Yeah. Oh my gosh. Yeah, that was a devastating moment for me. And you know, for those of you who haven't, you know, read that part of it, you know, the exchange is really, really short. You know, I can read it.
You
know,
I think you should read it. I've got it marked here. Okay. Where is it? I can tell you what
page it's on. Page 36, I think.
Okay, yes.
So I'll just read this very short section. A few years ago, during the City of Vancouver's Year of Reconciliation events, I was at a dinner meeting at a restaurant on Water Street. I was one of a few poets that was commissioned to write a poem in response to the Truth and Reconciliation Commission. The initiative was called Reconciliation Through Poetry. The work that the poets were engaging with was meant to honor the work of Chief Robert Joseph. At the dinner meeting, the poets, along with a few administrators, talked with Chief Robert Joseph, exchanged stories, and discussed what reconciliation meant for both Indigenous and non-Indigenous peoples. After a while, Chief Joseph directed his attention to me and asked me where I was from. I told him that I was Niska and that my grandparents were from Kinkolith. After a few moments, he said, "You're not really Niska. Some of my friends are Niska. Do you know how I can tell?" If you were really Niska, you would have said Niska with a K sound. Niska. You said Nishka with an SH sound. You know, I didn't really know how to respond to that. My grandparents are Niska, my dad is Niska, but to a certain extent, he was right. I wasn't born in Kinkolith, I was born in Vancouver, moved when I was very young, and essentially grew up in Ontario. Does that make me less Niska?
Oh, yeah.
I find that encounter to be so puncturing, you know, in so many ways. And, you know, I think part of the difficulty too is that, you know, it's not the first and only encounter, you know, it's one in a series of many encounters, you know, that I've had with folks, you know, who, you know, really, you know, want to draw very specific boundaries around what it means to be Indigenous, mm-hmm. and want to say that there are, you know, that there is, you know, just maybe like one very specific way to be Indigenous. And I think that was so difficult for me.
Oh, you know? Absolutely. My heart broke for you. My heart broke when I was reading that, you know, because language is so important to who we are. And I don't know my language. You know, I think I now know about maybe 10 words, if I'm lucky, and phrases, and it sounds familiar to my ear, but so foreign to my tongue. You know, it's so difficult to navigate that, and you feel so helpless and sad. All these emotions are wrapped up in that, because that was something that was stolen from you that's generation stolen, right? That's stolen because of what happened to your grandparents yes. in the schools. And then it's all the heaped on trauma. And then there are so many of us that grew up totally disconnected from community and grew up in cities from, and if you're a mixed person like me, I mean, my father was Polish, you grew up in Ontario or in Toronto, a big city where there's a lot of people that come from different backgrounds, you know, struggling to find who you are and connect with community is such a difficult thing.
Absolutely. I think even just that phrase, like, you know, I don't speak my language, you know, like that's, you know, there's, you know, I think, just like thinking of it, like, you know, my language as this thing that should be intimately, you know, a part of me, that should be connected to me, that's missing, you know, and, yes. you know, I think, you know, you're right. You know, I think, you know, I think we're so often asked, you know, to connect, you know, with our languages, to return to traditional knowledges, and, you know, to return to speaking to each other, you know, and other non-Indigenous peoples, you know, through our languages. And I totally believe in that, you know, 100%. And at the same time, you know, I want to point to the difficulties, you know, in finding those pathways forward, you know, finding pathways back to language, you know, back to culture, back to, you know, what others, including folks like Leanne Simpson, have described as mm-hmm. Indigenous resurgence, you know, mm-hmm. and, you know, I think in many ways that's the pathway forward. You know, and at the same time, you know, I think we have to be so incredibly kind to each other, and mm-hmm. you know, and understanding, you know, and of each other, you know, about how deeply colonialism and genocide have impacted us and our relationships to communities and to access to knowledge and language.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Absolutely. I had a discussion with Lee Maracle. She gave the Margaret Lawrence lecture recently, and I urge you to listen to it, because she just punched a big old hole through the Margaret Lawrence lectures.
Amazing.
It was incredible. And, you know, and she was talking about that, and she just, of course, blew my mind, as she always does. She was talking about how we are even telling our stories in the language of the colonizers. I'm speaking to you in English, right? And the stories of the land, if you want to know the stories of Canada, you have to know the stories of the land. And that's from our nations, right? From where our families are from. And there's that disconnect. We don't speak our languages, so. And she was making those points, and I was just feeling everything she was saying. And I see it echoed in your work. I see it echoed all over. And I just want you to know that there's lots of us out there like you.
I truly appreciate that, really. And, you know, I think, you know, in so many ways, you know, I think that that's the core of this book too, you know, that so many of us feel this way or have these experiences or disconnected, you know, by no fault of our own, you know, from community, and that we don't talk about those experiences nearly enough. I think, you know, they're not normalized in the same ways that other Indigenous experiences are normalized. And, you know, I wrote this book, or I continued to write this book, you know, in part because I kept feeling that this was an area of silence, you know, in our communities and in our writings, even, you know, and that, you know, we and that, you know, my my thinking and my approach to all of this, you know, has just been, you know, trying to be one of openness and transparency, you know, and just to relay my experiences, you know, as openly and as transparently as I can. And, mm-hmm. you know, and it, in part because I'm sure there are many, many others, you know, who may be listening to this podcast, you know, who feel in like they're in a similar position, you know, but without the words to put to it.
Mm. The miracle also says something to me once, and it really made me think and appreciate her, and also trusting that instinct of being an Anishinaabe storyteller that's inside of me that you just have to listen to. And she said, you know, your writing is circular. You loop into the future, you go to the past, and you come to the present. You see all those things when you write. And that is the mark of a First Nations writer.
Wow, that really speaks to me right at this current moment, actually. I, you know, so at the very end of Nishka, you know, I kind of, you know, gesture towards my next project. It's just this project called Empty Spaces, which is so much about returning to and circling back around and just, you know, being in that cycle of constantly looping back and moving forward and then looping back again. And yeah, that really resonates with me.
And that is a perfect way to leave this conversation: circular, looking forwards, backwards, and in the present, all in the same time.
Yes, absolutely, all together.
This has been a beautiful, beautiful conversation. You know, I'm looking forward to the day where I can see you in person.
Absolutely. And hopefully sometime soon. Got my fingers crossed.
yes. And chimigwech for all of your words.
Thank you so much, Tanya. This has been amazing. I'm really appreciative of being in conversation with you.
I, as soon as I was offered, I'm like, yes, I would love to.
Amazing.
Thank you, Jordan and Tanya, very much for joining us on Books and Ideas Audio, a presentation of the Vancouver Writers Fest. We're very honored to have you here today.